Hey guys, it's me, Camille.
And me, Tim. And we want to start the show by taking you back a little bit, maybe to when you were a kid and you were just starting to learn about clubs, you know, exclusive groups, the cliques, that kind of stuff.
Like secret member things?
Yeah, like secret member things, you know, being in the special group. Usually there's special rules and rituals, maybe even a secret handshake.
If you were cool enough.
I was never cool enough to be in any kind of cool clubs.
Me neither.
All right, we digress. So on today's show, we're talking about a considerably larger club, one that's designed to be very, very inclusive, at least on the surface. Maybe the biggest club in the entire country.
Yeah, we've been joking around the office that we should call it the Democracy Club.
I kind of prefer Club Democracy. It has a different ring to it, I think.
Okay. Club Democracy as in voting. Guys, we are dipping our toes into the politics pool.
Right. But in our own special way, in the way
we live here way.
Exactly. So as you guys know, we're all about systems on the show, and we thought, hey, there's a big election coming up. Maybe you've heard about it. So it's probably a good time to delve into this most American system, the voting system.
And we begin not here in St. Louis, but just a little bit north, in Wisconsin, in fact, where a 30-something-year-old man named Zach Moore has just stepped into a DMV office to get the credentials he needs to get into the Democracy Club.
All right, what can I do for you today?
I can't even get a Wisconsin ID.
Oh, Wisconsin ID? Okay, you have to get the ID.
Did you guys catch that? Zach's trying to get a Wisconsin ID. He recently moved to Wisconsin from Illinois, and he's brought with him a Social Security card, a check stub, but not a birth certificate, which is a huge sticking point for the clerk.
My birth certificate is in Illinois, so.
Okay, you're gonna have to get it. I cannot give you, we can't issue one without it.
Is there not the petition process available?
That last voice belongs to a woman named Molly McGrath. In fact, she's the reason we're able to hear this encounter in the first place. She recorded it secretly back in September.
Because Molly's not just a friend of Zach's. She's actually with a nonpartisan group called Vote Writers. And prior to this recording, she spent months helping people comply with Wisconsin's new voter ID law.
The new law requires people to have a specific type of photo ID when they vote. It can be something like a Wisconsin's driver's license or a state ID or a passport. But Zach's ID card from Illinois won't work. So he's trying to get it switched to Wisconsin. But to do that, he needs a bunch of documents. And when the clerk tells Zach he can't get an ID to vote because he doesn't have his Illinois birth certificate, Molly, posing as a friend, speaks up.
Okay. Because I read about, like, that you could just get, like, show up with whatever documents you have and you get a free ID for voting.
We can start the petition process, but it's contingent upon Illinois responding. So we don't know how long that would take with Illinois. If you have the birth certificate and it's just a matter of mailing, I would do that, honestly.
Okay, so even if you initiate the petition process,
well,
you're not going to get
it if you have the birth certificate and you're planning on mailing it. You know what I mean?
Right, but I'm just wondering how that would work. Like, for like, if you initiate the petition process, do you get an ID for voting?
No, you don't get anything right away.
You don't get anything.
Okay, so just so even if we start the petition process and it takes 8 weeks,
right.
He won't be able to vote.
Right. Well, I don't know. They're working on that, so it's kind of up in the air right now. So if you want more information, we get you to the supervisor over at window 3 while we do that.
Are you guys frustrated?
Yeah, I mean, even by DMV standards, no offense to anybody at the DMV, but I mean, this is pretty frustrating.
Molly's asking about a petition process, but the clerks seem confused. In fact, everybody kind of seems confused. So moments later, a supervisor steps in.
All right, so what's going on?
Do you get an ID?
I'm trying to get a Wisconsin ID so I can vote.
Okay.
I don't have my birth certificate, but I got everything else.
Okay.
And then the other option she said is I can have my sister mail my birth certificate down there.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm trying to figure out the other process, like how long would that take?
6 to 8 weeks.
Ooh.
The DMV supervisor tells Zach the best thing he can do is get his old birth certificate or pay for a new one. He says maybe Zach could get a family member living in Illinois to help him out, or maybe he could drive there himself. But he makes it very clear that there is no guarantee Zach will have what he needs to vote come November. Molly jumps in again.
I thought there was, like, you could get an ID if you, like, the sign over there, it's like, no birth certificate, no problem, you can get an ID to vote.
You can. It just takes the time.
So even if we just start the petition process, you wouldn't get anything temporarily that says you can vote?
No.
Okay, so no. I do see that.
No, that's why it's just...
A couple of minutes later, the visit is over. Zach leaves the DMV with no ID.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Good luck to you, friend.
Thanks.
Bye. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. We have to talk about this. They're not following the law.
Not serving.
Weeks later, a federal judge would agree with Molly. He ruled that there were major flaws with how the state of Wisconsin rolled out its voter ID law.
But here's the thing. In recent years, there's been a wave of states that have enacted new laws like this that change who can vote and how.
Yeah, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, strict photo ID laws started becoming popular in 2008.
So on today's show, we travel the country to answer a seemingly simple question. What does it take to get into club democracy?
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
We live here.
A project exploring
race,
class,
power,
poverty,
systems and the people they touch.
I'm Camille Stanley.
And I'm Tim Lloyd. And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Now, we should back up and explain just what had Molly, the activist we heard on the secret recording, so stunned.
And what she meant by people breaking the law.
This year, Molly's organization, Vote Writers, focused its efforts on Wisconsin because that state has one of the nation's strictest photo ID laws.
Proponents of rules like this, often Republicans, say these laws are needed to cut back on voter fraud. But legal experts point out that the type of fraud a photo ID could actually prevent, like a person pretending to be somebody else at the ballot box, is really rare.
In fact, Justin Levitt, a law professor at Loyola University, went through the millions of votes cast since 2000, and he found just 31 credible instances of the type of voter fraud photo ID laws are designed to prevent.
And Molly and others say you can't ignore the racial implications of laws like these. For instance, according to one often cited 2006 survey by the Brennan Center for Justice, roughly 25% of blacks nationally don't have a photo ID that could work at the ballot box. That's compared to only 8% for whites.
On top of that, Molly says these laws can also limit voter turnout among poor people, young people, and the elderly.
Experts have testified in federal court that in Wisconsin, it's approximately 300,000 registered voters who do not have an ID to vote.
So she and her colleagues have been doing outreach to people who may not know about the new law or how to get the credentials they need.
Yes, so Zach and I met at a church community meal where I do regular outreach. And we talked about voting and talked about what he would need to vote in Wisconsin. And he had an Illinois ID. And I said, don't worry. Because in Wisconsin, since we have such a strict law, there's a safety net in place. The safety net is called the ID petition process. And it means that essentially Wisconsin will talk to the other states and the vital records in whichever state that voter was born and verify their birth. They'll kind of do a behind-the-scenes check and make sure that Zach Moore really is Zach Moore and born in Chicago, and verify that for him, and then send his ID to him.
There is a catch, though. This safety net petition process, as we heard on Molly's secret recording, can take weeks, sometimes as long as 2 months.
This past summer, a federal judge ordered state officials to come up with a solution. Officials agreed that while a person was waiting for their documents to be verified, they'd essentially get a temporary voting card, and they're supposed to get that temporary voting card within a few days. So when Molly and Zach went to the DMV this past September, that's what they were expecting to have happen.
In fact, Molly later found out that the same day she recorded what happened to Zach, state officials sent a glowing report to the judge, declaring that everything with voter ID was going well.
Well, really, I almost couldn't believe what was happening because this was, like you said, weeks, months after a federal judge's order, and you know, 6 weeks before the election. I was happy I was with Zach, but what was happening to voters across the states who got that information? How many voters even today got that information and are purchasing their birth certificate on their own or not going to vote because of poor information that they received?
Molly sent her recording of Zach's encounter at the DMV and others gathered by other volunteers at other DMVs to journalists. The tapes were a game changer.
A federal judge hauled officials back into court for a two-day hearing. Molly had to testify for a couple of hours about what she found. The state then promised changes and said going forward, DMV workers would be retrained.
But Molly says she doesn't think DMV workers are to blame.
And the problem that I see is that the DMV wears a lot of hats. They do license plates. They do driver's license tests. They do a lot of different things there. And now we're tasking them with the responsibility of issuing a credential for a constitutional fundamental right to vote. And that's different from messing up on the expiration date on your license plate tags. This is an issue with a lot of gravity that we're tasking the DMV with. And, you know, what we seem to learn here is that, you know, the state of Wisconsin really didn't have the ability to implement this law without violating these constitutional rights. And instead, we're reacting to the tapes and reacting to things messing up. And I think we can all look forward to the day when Wisconsin proactively protects constitutional rights instead of reacting to the disenfranchisement of voters.
Activists like Molly are not the only people who believe strongly that voting rights, who has them and who doesn't, are a fundamental issue for society.
Voting rights are one of the ways that a democratic society defines membership.
Greg Magarian is a law professor at Washington University here in St. Louis, and he says it's something everyone should be concerned about.
But the grant or denial or extension or exclusion of voting rights is a way of saying you are really a part of this country and this political society, and you aren't.
Magarian says despite many people's lofty ideas about America, voting in this country was originally designed to be exclusive. After all, voting was originally reserved for white guys, in particular white guys who owned property.
And gradually those qualifiers over time went away. Property qualifications went away first, and then with the Civil War and the abolition of slavery, the formal, at least, denial of voting rights based on race went away. It still obviously was and remains a huge problem as a practical matter, but as a legal matter, that changed. Sex went away with the enfranchisement of women, and the age qualification then changed, I guess it was the early 70s when the vote went down from 21 to 18. So these are all moments at which, in a very important way, ingrained in the Constitution, we're saying these people who have formerly been denied this full participation, this full membership in society, now get that. And that just changes the identity of the nation. It changes how we think of ourselves.
While many observers say ID laws like the one in Wisconsin make voting prohibitive, there are plenty of people on the other side worried that voting already is easy, too easy. In the past few weeks and months, it's been hard to escape the discourse about voter fraud and election rigging. And like elsewhere, the political back and forth about voting laws has bled into the state where we live and work, Missouri.
To help us make sense of what's happening in Missouri, joining us in studio is St. Louis Public Radio's political reporter, Jason Rosenbaum. Hey, Jason.
Thanks for having me back.
Hey, good to see ya.
Yeah, let's get down to business. So over the past couple of weeks, in the presidential contest, we've been hearing a lot about election fraud, voter fraud, the rigged election. But you've been hearing this kind of talk for a long time.
Not only before this election, but for the past decade, Republicans in Missouri have pushed a measure requiring voters to show a government-issued photo ID at the polls. And after many false starts and legislative failures, supporters of a photo ID requirement are very close to achieving their goal.
But if I'm not mistaken, they still have a couple hurdles first, right?
They do, and I'll try to hash it out the best way that I possibly can. Because of a 2006 court decision, the only way to implement a photo ID requirement in Missouri is to pass a constitutional amendment that authorizes such a measure. The legislature put that amendment on the ballot earlier this year, and voters will decide whether to approve the measure, known as Amendment 6, on November 8th.
So if voters approve Amendment 6, what will happen?
Around the same time lawmakers approved the constitutional amendment, they also passed another bill that would spell out how the parameters around the photo ID requirement would work. This bill would go into effect next year if voters approve the constitutional amendment.
And, of course, if they say no to that constitutional amendment, this is all a moot point.
You might as well throw that bill I just mentioned in the trash because it's worthless.
Sure.
So glad we got that procedure stuff out of the way. But, Jason, my big question is why are Missouri Republicans so intent on getting a photo ID law on the books? I mean, other states have done this and they've had a lot of court challenges.
Well, let me take a few minutes to lay everything out. What it comes down to is that many Republicans believe that a photo identification requirement will make it harder for people to commit voter fraud. Some supporters, like GOP State Representative Shamed Dogan, point to how you need a photo ID to board a commercial airplane. He says the same principles should apply to voters.
It's common sense that you ought to be able to prove who you are to vote. You don't want someone casting your vote in your place. You don't want somebody who's not eligible to vote showing up to the polls and voting on behalf of either someone else or someone who doesn't exist necessarily.
Republican lawmakers in other states have put forward photo identification requirements, and many of them have faced legal challenges, including one in North Carolina that's become a central aspect of that state's governor's race. But supporters like Dogan feel that Missouri's implementation law is different. For one thing, it would pay for supporting documents that are required to obtain a government-issued photo ID, like a birth certificate. It would also allow people without photo IDs to cast provisional ballots.
Voter fraud is a real phenomenon. You know, we can argue over how much it happens and what the easiest types of voter fraud are, but I think it's delusional to say that voter fraud doesn't exist.
So what type of voter fraud is Dogan actually talking about? State Representative Justin Offerman, a Republican from Herman, points to recent incidents where people fraudulently registered to vote, gathered initiative petition signatures, or cast absentee ballots.
And still, to this very instant, at the point that I'm talking to you, Democrats are still decrying, oh, well, you know, we don't have fraud. We don't have in-person fraud. So they've changed the argument of what they're actually saying. And I think it's extremely naive of us to think that in-person voter fraud doesn't also exist whenever we have pure examples of other types of voter fraud happening in our state.
Perhaps unsurprisingly, Democratic opponents of photo ID disagree strongly with Alperman's contention. Take Robin Smith. She's the Democratic nominee for Secretary of State, and she's made fighting the photo ID amendment one of her top campaign planks. She and other Democrats feel photo ID is a solution in search of a problem, and she says it would make it harder for thousands of people to vote.
Who are they? They're the ones we want to protect the most. They're the fragile, the elderly. They're veterans. They are college students who are just trying to get an education. They are minorities. They are those who are disabled and don't own a vehicle, and therefore don't have a driver's license.
There's some evidence that Smith and other Democrats aren't going to let photo ID pass in Missouri without a fight. On the Sunday afternoon before the second presidential debate at Washington University, some prominent Democrats were sounding off against photo ID at the Missouri History Museum. In front of a big blue Democratic National Committee bus, U.S. Representative Lacey Clay says there's a moral obligation to oppose the proposal. He brought up the three civil rights workers who were murdered in 1964 while registering black voters in Mississippi.
You know, Cheney, Swerner, and Goodman did not die in vain, and we need to make it clear to the people that run the state legislature that we won't tolerate it.
Now, Jason, I know you're hesitant to make predictions about elections because I have a lot of friends who are political reporters and they hate doing that type of stuff. But is there any sense of how close the vote over this constitutional amendment about photo IDs is going to be?
Well, usually if a group is spending lots of money to get Missourians to vote against a ballot item, it makes it more likely the measure will fail. There's been a little over $100,000 invested to defeat the amendment, but that's not a lot in the grand scheme of elections. What may be a bigger factor is the national environment. If Democrats turn out big to support Hillary Clinton in Missouri, they may also vote against the photo identification amendment. If Donald Trump has a big night, then Amendment 6 may pass as well.
All right. Well, thanks, Jason.
Thank you.
Bye. While states like Missouri and Wisconsin have embraced photo ID, voters in other parts of the country are grappling with a different question. Is there any way to get back into the Democracy Club if you've been kicked out? After the break, we go to the East Coast, where the fight over felons' voting rights is brewing.
What are the powers of the governor? And has the governor overstepped those powers?
As we've already heard, the U.S. has a long history of choosing who it will and won't let participate in the voting system. And despite the fact that big classes of people have gained their rights to vote over the past several decades, there's still a group of people largely left out of the system. In many places in this country, a criminal conviction also means losing your right to vote.
In fact, according to a report by the nonprofit Sentencing Project, which does national research and advocacy around criminal justice issues, more than 6 million Americans won't be able to vote in November because of a criminal conviction. More than a third of those people are Black. And denying felons the right to vote has a distinct and historic racial component, says University of Missouri law professor David Mitchell.
When we go back in time, if you look at sort of post-Reconstruction or post-Civil War, you will see that there were a number of amendments, state constitutional amendments, that were passed that addressed particularly or created sort of new laws that would sort of allow for African Americans to be arrested at higher rates. And so you began to see a number of different sort of rules put in place that said if you were convicted of certain crimes, ranging from felonies, crimes involving moral turpitude, that you would be barred from voting. In particular, there's a constitutional amendment, I believe it was the Alabama Constitutional Amendment in 1906, that where they said on the floor, actually specifically, that we're passing this to disenfranchise African Americans, right? And it was very clear. And so you've got this legal framework that sort of couches itself in this constitutional standard of disenfranchising individuals.
But in one state, that recently changed. Last spring, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe made national headlines when, in one fell swoop, he restored the voting rights of some 200,000 felons.
Mallory Nopain is a producer in Richmond, Virginia, and she's been following this decision. She shared with us a great story she did on efforts to register ex-felons in Virginia. But before we play it, Mallory describes the scene at a surprise press conference from the governor.
And it wasn't just your average press conference. The governor stood on the steps of the Capitol here, which is this big, white, imposing building designed by Thomas Jefferson. There was a choir and a crowd of people. There were felons there who had been invited by the governor's office that didn't even know what was going to be happening. And he stood up there and he sort of declared that he was tearing down the last vestige of African-American disenfranchisement in the state.
And so today, I will sign an order restoring the civil and voting rights of every single individual who has completed his or her sentence as of this day, April 22nd, 2016.
It was pretty inspiring. People were crying and shouting. It was a big occasion. People on the street were pretty excited and working hard to get as many people registered as quickly as possible. And so I got really curious about that. I wanted to know what was going on with the people who were directly affected by this huge policy shift. This story is about a day I spent with Karen Fountain, a community organizer with a left-leaning New Virginia majority.
I head over to this area because there's a lot of former felons.
Fountain has been registering voters throughout Richmond. The day I joined her, we visited Gilpin Court.
That is a low-income neighborhood, basically. A lot of guys and some girls, but more so men that have been used to be locked up. And it's still a lot that did not know that they have had their rights restored.
Felons in Virginia are disproportionately Black. Before McAuliffe's order, one in five African Americans in Virginia weren't eligible to vote because of their criminal records. Republicans say their opposition to the order has nothing to do with race. Half of felons who have had their rights restored are white. That's an argument Fountain and everyone I talk to in Gilpin Court doesn't buy. Republicans say this isn't about race. What do you say to that?
I think, how can I say this? Okay, I know that it is about race. Now, you say it's about crime. With some people, they don't separate the two. I just say it like that.
Do you think it's about suppressing that vote from that race?
Absolutely. I think they want to that not to go forth. They still want to keep African-American men and the women down, like it's slavery time. They still act like it's slavery time, and this is not slavery time. I feel violated, even though I'm not an ex-offender, but because I'm an African-American. And it's a good thing that's in place. People will have an opportunity to vote. When you vote and you make that check, that's your voice being heard. It's a brother, and his name is Randy. And he knows the history of everything over here.
Fountain cruises the neighborhood, looking for someone she knows. Soon, a man named Andre West rides by on his bike.
Hey! All right, you got a minute?
West isn't an ex-felon, but he knows this community well, and he's been helping Fountain connect with people and register them. West says the atmosphere here has changed since the governor's order.
Most felons, they get into stuff, then they can't get out of it. But now they get that right still, they can get out of that trouble that they're in. And people been doing things they should be doing, not things they shouldn't be doing.
I turn around and Fountain's off, already chasing somebody down.
How y'all doing?
I already voted.
Y'all already voted? Yeah. You mean registered? Yeah.
At first, people treat her like a salesman, wary eyes saying they're not interested, but she just laughs and smiles. She's persistent.
Oh yeah, please excuse me, honey. I talked to so many people. I'm sorry.
Around the corner, there's a small crowd of men hanging outside an abandoned building. Karen brings up voting and elections, and it taps into attention.
You don't see anything. So yeah. I'm like, sometimes I said, what's the use though? Because Congress going to still do what they do. But I think, yeah.
Lee Vinson isn't a felon, but he was raised in this neighborhood and knows many who are.
They want you to go out there and vote and this and all that, but we really don't see no changes though. I don't. I'm 52 years old. I ain't seen no difference yet though.
As we're talking, an older gentleman walks up, waving a card proudly in the air.
He voted this morning.
His name is Anthony Crawford, and he voted in a primary for his congressman. Fountain registered him herself.
Yeah.
Check that out. That's your voting card.
Yeah. I used it this morning for the first time in 61 years.
When he was young, Crawford says he didn't care about voting. Then in 1992, he did 6 months for breaking and entering. Now, with the restoration order, he's able to vote again.
I didn't even know how to do it. I would walk around and say, what you do? I said, this is my first time. They said, go around the back on the other side, you know.
Practice, he says, for November.
Do you know who you'll vote for in November for president?
Yeah, Hillary. Yeah, no question.
Another of the men pipes up. He's been standing to the side, eyeing my microphone carefully. He also has a felony on his record. He did not want to be recorded or even have his name on the radio. But he did have a point he wanted to make. Even now that his rights are restored, he will not be voting. My little one vote, he says, it isn't going to make a difference.
So what's happened since you spent time with Karen this summer?
Yeah, so that was way back in June, and a lot has happened since then. There was a Virginia Supreme Court case. The Republicans challenged the governor's actions, saying that it wasn't constitutional, that he overstepped his role. Essentially, Virginia's constitution denies felons the right to vote, but gives the governor the power to restore those rights, but not without first overcoming an additional hurdle. Richard Kelsey is a legal expert I talked to.
At the end of the day, this really is and should be a straight legal question. What are the powers of the governor? And has the governor overstepped those powers? And as it has been interpreted since the beginning of time, that is a case-by-case restoration process.
So in the end, the state Supreme Court sided with Republicans. They said that the governor's order was unconstitutional. So essentially everything was rolled back.
All right. So there's this court decision. So then what does the governor do after that?
The governor was fairly defiant. He said, you know, I'm not done here. I'm going to keep plugging away. So even though the court told him he couldn't restore rights en masse to everybody at one time, he said he was going to start chipping through the list of 200,000 person by person. So they have a long list of people. And in the governor's office, there's a staff, 2 full-time people, 4 part-time people, and their job is working their way through that list. They check with other departments, the Department of Corrections, Juvenile Justice, Department of Health, to make sure that these individuals aren't still institutionalized somewhere or owe fines to anybody or to the state or any departments. And then once somebody is given the green light, they send that individual a restoration order and a voter application form.
How many people have they been able to restore the rights to?
It's been just over 3 months, and they've restored rights to almost 70,000 individuals. And I should say that number of people, the 2 full-time and 4 part-time staff, that's the same number of people that have been in those positions in the felon restoration department for years. This isn't like a larger number of staff.
Wow. Yeah. But, you know, I want to ask, too, though, were Republicans satisfied with this decision, going down this list one by one? I mean, is the fight still on, so to speak?
Well, at this point, the fight is not still on, but initially they were not satisfied. They actually asked the Virginia Supreme Court to hold the governor in contempt of court. They were saying that what he was doing is kind of, it's just a difference in semantics. He was still restoring votes en masse. But this time the court sided with the governor, and so the governor's good to go to just keep on plugging. He says he hopes to get through the list of 200,000 by the end of the year.
So what about Karen, that woman that you spent so much time with this summer?
Yeah, so soon after I went out with her, Karen actually moved on to North Carolina to do similar work, registering people to vote. That's where she was when she found out that Virginia Supreme Court overturned the governor's action. So essentially at that point, everyone she had just registered was no longer eligible. I met up with her recently and asked her what went through her mind when she found out that had happened.
They really do not think that the ex-offenders that have went in and served their time still don't have a right to vote. They are really still trying to keep them ex-offenders imprisoned in their mind and still don't think that they are worthy of being back in society. And I could not and still don't understand that. But after continuing to follow and finding out how Governor McAuliffe had to do it, I had a sense of relief because they may have slowed him down. I was glad the Supreme Court did not put a full stop to it. So basically the Supreme Court was on his side and they agreed. But he just had to go back. Do it one by one.
You said you try to understand it. You say you can't understand it. Do you ever try, and when you do, what happens? Like, do you ever think maybe, what is it that you think they think?
Honestly, now you know me, Mallory, I'm gonna keep it real. Anybody that would think that someone who has went in a penal institution, served their time for no matter what it is, and came out and still try to keep them in bondage, as I stated before, you just want to keep them in slavery. You want to keep them enchained and helping them to think that they are not worth anything, and keeping their self-esteem low, thinking that they are no account, they are outcasts.
So, full disclosure, when we first started planning this show months ago, we had no idea that this issue of who's in and who's out of club democracy would become a major storyline down the home stretch of the election.
Or that it would stir up so many emotions about what America is and who gets to represent it.
And we want to leave you with a couple things that really stuck with us during our reporting. The first thought comes from the University of Missouri law professor David Mitchell.
Consider the very simple things, right? We have long discussed and talked about the fact that the voting process that we have is inconsistent and creates burdens and challenges to individuals who work on a daily basis. And so there's long been pushes to make election, you know, voting day, right, election day, a national holiday. And those have not gone very far, right? We've created mechanisms for early voting to address some of those issues. And those constantly are under attack. We've created mechanisms for same-day registration, and those are under attack.
Mitchell says when you really step back and think about it, this idea of universal suffrage in America is actually a myth, and that if we were serious about hearing the voices of all our citizens, we'd create a system capable of reaching that idea.
But before you start getting super depressed about that thought, we want to circle back to one more thing, or rather, one more man. It's Zach Moore. You heard him at the very beginning of this show. He's a Wisconsin transplant who's trying to get his ID to vote.
We asked Molly, the voting activist, what ended up happening to him. And in fact, just the day before our interview, she'd been with Zach at the DMV.
And this was after the retrainings and the new information and the new poster and the new documents. And we went there and I was like, Zach, this is because of you, you know, this new document, this poster. And he was like, wow, you know, I can't believe, you know, that I did this. And I'm like, you know, you shared your story and your experience. And, you know, this is the positive change that you made. So voters in your position don't experience what you experienced. So yesterday we did enter the ID petition process. So we're expecting that he will get his credential to vote in about 6 days or so. So he'll have that, you know, in time for his 34th birthday.
Molly says what gets Zach excited is the chance to vote for someone he thinks represents him and his community.
We Live Here is produced by me, Tim Lloyd.
And me, Camille Stanley.
Shula Newman is our editor.
And Cassie Morgan composed our theme music.
And from St. Louis Public Radio, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.